to the mail, to the mailbag, Jeff Feld. I'm going to be leaving you a little bit before midnight tonight. I've got another one of these early morning interviews, trying to hire some more antenna engineers. So I'm trying to get home a little bit earlier tonight, if you know what I mean. K2KEY, ready to go to the mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW
in the TechNet.
You
want to
comment before you go to Mel?
Okay, we're hearing you pretty well now. Howie, go ahead with your comment.
Just want to let you know that you're being heard on 10 meters. I wasn't being interfered with before. Your repeater has priority. If somebody keys up, they can talk over me. But I'm on IRLP, so I got both 440 and 10 meters, and people are emailing me and saying they're enjoying the TechNet.
Understand. Yeah, as the KE2, I'm terrible in names, as Andy and company are hooking up VOIP and other interconnections, more and more people are hearing the segment. Time to go to the mailbag, Jeff Mel. KQRIW.
Truly frightening.
Okay, very good. All right, one of the comments I got here, in fact, you know, this is what went on this week, you know, Paul really didn't get into it, about shooting down that satellite. Oh boy, I seem to have gotten a lot of questions here on it. I'll just take a couple at random. And they said here, why does that, I thought once a satellite is launched into space, it lives its life in space and then eventually comes back and burns up in the atmosphere. Why is this one different, and why was, did this satellite have a heat shield, supposedly? So they got a couple of them asking that question. And why don't, if so, if they can be brought back, why don't they bring back all the satellites that stopped working for service, you know, or recycling them? Well, I don't know. You want to briefly say something about this? The shoot down one, what the deal was, Dick, over.
Yeah, there's a lot more here going on than first meets the eye. First of all, when you launch a satellite in space, one of the first choices you make is which one of the three kinds of satellite is it? LEO, MEO, or GEO? LEO means low Earth orbit. They don't last for a very large number of years. They continuously experience some Earth atmosphere, upper atmosphere drag, and they eventually re-enter the atmosphere. That's what happens to most low Earth orbit LEOs. The MEOs, for instance, the GEO positioning, global positioning satellites at 10,000 miles, medium Earth orbit, they last thousands of years. You put them into orbit. And getting them back requires as much boost power as it took to get them there in the first place. You're never going to get one of them back. And geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles, they're the ones that sit at a fixed point in space as far as an Earthbound observer is concerned. You launch one there, and it's going to last for maybe 100,000 years, something really long. In fact, that's one-dimensional, very valuable real estate. Let me drop. And once you launch a satellite in geosynchronous orbit, the Intelsat agreement you agree to is that you're going to keep it within 1 cubic mile of your particular one-dimensional address. Geosynchronous orbit, geostationary orbit, is directly above the equator at exactly 22,300 miles altitude above the Earth, and your only address is what longitude are you at. It's a string of beads up there, and there's all kinds of perturbing forces that want to mass concentrations and solar wind and everything else wants to shift your satellite away from its designated address, and you have to do a burn periodically to keep it at your agreed-upon address point. At the end of life, when you start losing, when you come to the end of your consumables, the geostationary orbit, geosynchronous orbit satellite must be blasted into a larger orbit, higher altitude, the graveyard is up. Everything higher in altitude than geosynchronous orbit slowly spirals outward. The moon, for instance, used to be at one-third its current orbit millions of years ago. It's slowly spiraling outward. Everything closer in than geosynchronous orbit very slowly spirals inward if it's not experiencing gravity. So rescuing satellites at NEO and GEO altitude, out of the question. Bringing them back down, out of the question. You just don't have the resources to do that. You can't get there to repair it. You can't bring it back down because you don't have the same size booster that put it there in the first place. And a lot of people say, well, just send it out into space. Nice, easy words. It takes a great big booster to do that. The end-of-life geosynchronous orbits get blasted to a very slightly higher altitude, and you watch them very slowly spiral outward. By moving them outward, you take them out of the way, and you stop them from being a hazard for the next thing you're going to send up. You've got to worry about that. There's a lot of space junk out there, and all of it has to be very carefully plotted as to where it is and where it's going to be in the future to make sure that your future space missions don't run into that stuff. Space is very large, and the your material, we got thousands and thousands of pieces of stuff in orbit. A lot of it's active, some of it's inactive, all of it's a hazard, and NORAD has to keep track of all of that to make sure you don't run into it. That's one thing. Let's see, that was another part of this question, as I remember. Oh, this particular satellite they shot down, let me drop. I think it was called USA 193 or something like that. It was a satellite owned by the NSO, National Surveillance Organization. It's one of the, they used to call them spook agencies that keep track of radio surveillance, optical surveillance, whatever. Radio intelligence, optical intelligence. So it probably had fancy radio equipment and fancy optical equipment on board. The fear is that when that satellite, which failed, it didn't get into its proper orbital altitude, and it's going to slowly spiral in. The fear is that some of that valuable hardware might survive reentry. If so, it becomes a hazard. If it hits something in a habitable area, it becomes a slight hazard if it survives enough for somebody to study the material itself because it contains proprietary information. On top of that, it had this pretty large hydrazine tank, a propellant used for geostationary positioning, for stationary positioning, and the possibility exists that tank would survive reentry. So by hitting it with another rocket, they gained three things with a surface-to-air missile, surface-to-orbital missile. They gained three things. Number one, they had practice with their surface-to-air missile hitting an extremely fast-moving target. The missile probably was moving something like 3,000 or 6,000 miles an hour when it got on fixed, but the satellite itself was moving 17,500 miles an hour. You could say that what they did was to almost hit a bullet with another bullet. It took extremely high accuracy to do that, and they got some practice out of doing that. Second of all, they did major damage to what they believe is proprietary hardware. And number three, they have very strong evidence that they did explode the hydrazine tank because there was no real significant explosives on board to the surface-to-air missile, but yet they did experience a significant explosion in space during the moment of impact. And most likely that is the material out of the hydrazine tank that you saw expanding in the space at that time. So that probably gives you partial explanation for why all of that took place. K2KEY.
K2LIW. Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Well, one of the questions is, was this satellite actually designed, I guess, to be brought back to Earth after some kind of mission up there? Because it did have a set of heat shields, and that's one of the reasons they sort of may survive the coming into the atmosphere within pretty much intact. What would be the reason if you say, I guess there must have been a reason that it had a heat shield, because that means they were going to get it back someday, Dick. Is that correct? Over.
I'm very skeptical that it contained a heat shield. Everything you put into space is extremely expensive. It takes you a few thousand dollars per pound to put something in just low Earth orbit. And higher orbits than that, where it's going to have any significant longevity, a lot more booster power is required. And would they waste the extra mass with the heat shield to do something at the end of life? I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I'm skeptical about that one. I'm having trouble believing that they intended to bring it back home. But even if they did, bear in mind now that even if they did intend to bring it back home, it would be a controlled maneuver where you bring it back to a very specific place where you've got wide open ocean like the Pacific. And so they would use that heat shield to bring it back to a very specific place where you recover the hardware. That's on the assumption it's under control. The problem was that this particular mission, as soon as it got into low Earth parking orbit, and it was about to go to the next boost phase, all power and computer control ceased. All communication with the satellite no longer existed. You had no control over it. So therefore, even if it contained the heat shield was not going to bring it back at the right place at the right time to do the right thing. So for a bunch of reasons, they had to blast it into smaller pieces, as I see it. Back to you, Mel, KQLIW.
QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I hate to bring up conspiracy theories, but do you think there's anything to the idea that the Chinese have demonstrated that they could knock out one of their satellites within the past year, and about this time we have a satellite that fails with fuel in it, and we managed to demonstrate to the world that we could take one down too?
Well, whenever you use a surface-to-air missile to bring down a satellite, it makes many people in many countries very uncomfortable. Because now they say, hey, you're creating a killer satellite system. Boy, that's a pretty hostile action. That's what many countries will say. It is my belief that the appropriate agencies are rather happy about the fact that the Chinese did that. It gave us a little bit more reason, a little bit less egg in our face when we do it. And I know that they appreciated the fact that they had a very nice opportunity to practice with their surface-to-air missile system. Their surface-to-air missile system was not intended in its original design to bring down this kind of a satellite. Quite a few changes had to be made. New orbital maneuvers had to be created in order to create this impact. And this impact is an unusual impact. Normally, when you destroy something, you hit it with a high-speed projectile. You shoot a gun at something. In this case, what you did is to bring the bullet into the right position and let the velocity of the vehicle do the damage. The surface-to-air missile, with its fragmentary explosive warhead, was only bringing a bunch of massive particles into the right position in space. It is the 17,500-mile velocity of the satellite itself that really did the damage. Back to you, Glenn. KQLIW.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. I think to the average person, you know, to think, oh, you shoot a missile at a satellite, it's a very simple task, and certainly the technical capability that was required and to actually to do that, it's a very, very interesting thing. You know, because that's why, it was one of those things, the first thing that always came to the back of my mind was, hey, didn't the Chinese kind of like show the world that they could do that within the past year? And here we are doing it now, and it's just, the timing of it just sounded a little fishy to me, that's all. K2RA, that's just KC2, QIQ.
Okay, Mel, you want to go to the, is there anything more to that particular mail, or you want to go to the next one?
A lot of redundancy here. Quite a number of questions about this. I guess everybody's got that sort of suspicion in the back of their mind, really, what's really behind all this jazz with this satellite. Okay. Anyhow, let's go on. Let me grab a couple of simple ones here. Like you didn't want to do a little earlier tonight, so let's just try a few of them. Reading down here. Oh, here's one. You once mentioned that you put together a very simple, cheap repeater. I am a retired person. I go down south to a retirement community. There are some camps at this community, but we do not have a repeater. can you tell me how I can put together a very reasonably priced repeater? I'm willing to do homebrewing. Well, I don't know. I can give some suggestions how I did it a long time ago. I put it together here. This is the dawn of amateur radio use of repeaters. We're on repeaters here, and so there wasn't availability at that time of many repeaters for amateur radio use here on repeaters. But I don't know what the situation today with purchase of repeaters. Are they very reasonable, or what's really the current status of repeaters now, or you think homebrewing is worth the effort? Go ahead.
HWW,
could
it ask
for
that question?
Why don't you take a crack at that one, Howie?
One way you could do this is you could do it for less than about $1,200. If it's going to be a UHF or a VHF repeat, you can get two GM300s, two mobile radios from eBay for about $150 each. You get a duplex that you use for about $400 or $500. It'll run about 10 or 15 watts. You got to run the radio at a low power. You obviously have to get a power supply and get a controller. So around $1,500 to $2,000, you can get all the equipment. You don't homebrew it, but you just have to hook it up correctly. You use a receiver, two radios. One radio would be the receiver, one radio would be the transmitter. If it's a 440 repeater, you get a PD526 duplexer. You can find duplexers on eBay for anywhere from $300 to $500. The two radios will run you about $300. A power supply would be about $150. And then, you know, you need an antenna and everything. So, and you need some hardline. If you shopped around, you could definitely do it. But you got to have some knowledge. You need some test equipment to set the levels up. You need equipment to tune it up. But, you know, if you got a few guys together, there's no reason why you can't do it. You could go out and buy a repeater from iCup for about $5,000 or $6,000 today. But you can build one for around $2,000. Go ahead, Nick.
And I think... Wrong mic again. I think those estimates are pretty good for a conventional repeater, reasonable range, reasonable power, single antenna for transmit and receive, by the classic technique. There have been a few people who have done it cheaper than that, as long as you're not looking for a Cadillac approach. If you really want a Volkswagen or a Hugo approach, there are people who have tried to cover a small area, like, say, for instance, a retirement community, a trailer park, for instance, and have done it with a split-site repeater, where one antenna in one area is doing the receiving, and a few hundred feet away, another antenna is doing the transmitting. When you do it with two separate antennas, you don't need a duplexing filter. You do have to have some way of getting the audio from one site to the other site. And that can be done with wiring, fiber optic, maybe another radio link. But there have been guys who have temporarily set up an extremely low power repeater by hooking together a pair of handy talkies, so to speak. One is designated as the transmitter, another was designated as the receiver, and they've got two separate antennas, some number of hundreds of feet apart. That has been done successfully if you only want small area of coverage. So I guess you could say you pay your money and takes your choice. I wonder if any of your guys have ever done any experimenting, Mel, with very low expensive, very low performance split site, a temporary slash temporary or slightly not exactly a permanent installation. I wonder if you guys have ever experimented with that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Can you make another comment, please?
Yeah, hold on now. Let Mel talk first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, this person here surely doesn't have that kind of money. All right, basically, how did I do my GD technical basic repeat? This is going back a lot of years, because the radio I used at the time was a TR-22. Drake had put out this little 1-watt so-called handy talkie. I mean, it was a bit of a load compared to what you have on the market today. So I took a TR-22, and I split it because there was a receiver board and then a transmitter board with crystal, nice crystal control, little radio, both receiver, transmitter, has a number of channels. And what I did is I actually separated, as I say, the two boards. I made, at the time, I made a duplexer. It was a homemade duplexer, just a ring, a hybrid ring, very simple. And also I made what they call, at that time you could call it a COR, C-O-R. It was a carrier-operated relay. Now, for the ID system on it, was just a cassette recorder that had a continuous loop. They sell, I don't know, you know if they're still available, they used to sell these cassettes that you could, the timing on it, was, in other words, would go around, you know, identify the repeater and then reset itself, in other words, with a continuous loop cassette. Or, say, some of the guys used even a cheapy little reel-to-reel tape recorder that they used to sell, these little ones that took these little 3-inch reels and just make a loop on it. And basically, that was the repeater. And I eventually did make homebrew cavity. I wanted to try and make homebrew cavity, and I made them out of copper pipes, out of sewer pipes. And running thread, I remember I used a quarter 20 running thread and the whole thing, and I did make six cavities once for that repeater when they did go to a little higher power, but initially it was the TR-22, and then we did it, they had, Drake came out with a TR-22 with a 10-watt amplifier, which was eventually added. But that was really the bare bones repeater that I had put together, Dick, at the dawn of time of repeater going.
If you followed that procedure today, and if a guy was crafty enough, would you say that that whole repeater could be built for maybe $500? What do you think, Mel?
A lot less than that. Most likely any one of them may have a TR-22 maybe still laying in the drawer that's useless. I got one here. I use it, you know, I keep it as a keepsake because that was my first step in support of Andy Talking. In fact, I ran a marathon with that thing, believe it or not, the original marathon. I was the first ham to run a marathon, run the New York City Marathon, and actually used a repeat to do the at that time I used it on Simplex, in fact. So anyhow, but if you have a TR-22 around, sure, nothing to it. Like I say, you could basically have an old cassette recorder. You most likely could make yourself a continuous loop, take a cassette apart, make a continuous loop. The carrier-operated relay system, the COR, is a simple device to put together. It just had an amplifier transistor, a delay transistor, and then another transistor that drove the relay. So very simple to put together, Dick. In fact, I made a remote control controller for it with another transistor. The investment was literally nothing, Dick. Over.
There's one other thing that can be done, and that is, there's not an absolute rule that the repeater has to repeat within the same band. You could build a repeater that listens on 2 meters. And retransmits on 430 or 440, or listens on 440 and retransmits on 2 meters. And there are a couple of rigs I remember. I think they were originally intended for satellite ham radio operations, where they would listen on one band and retransmit on another. I think there are a couple of Kenwood or Gaysu rigs that basically had a kind of split band repeater mode built in. And if you're listening on one band and transmitting on another, you may need no duplexing filter at all. I wonder if you've heard about that approach, Mel. K2KEY, then we'll go over to Howie right after that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Comment, K2OES.
OES, recognized. Mel first, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, Dick, with that little 1 watt, that CSTR-22, that little 1 watt, I'll tell you something. While they were still running the 1 watt, which really did that area, really was that the antenna was up. They were able to get the antenna up, really up in the clear. But I'll tell you that the hybrid ring, with just one tuned cavity stick, it worked exceptionally well. I was amazed. I used the shortest stuff to, you know, fine tune the thing, and that was it, basically. You know, you have the hybrid ring, and you have one for number one and for your receiver, and number two, another high for your transmitter, and one antenna with 1 watt, and that receiver was hot enough. Like I said, it was simple crystal control radio, thick. The whole thing, like I said, put together, I don't think it was, other than the TR-22 was laying around literally worthless. I don't think there's any sense in a thing like this, Dick. This is all basically what you most likely is going to find in what we were looking at in junk piles today, over.
Okay, and let the person building the inexpensive repeater know that one other thing is somewhat deterministic, somewhat predictable ahead of time. Go to a man who is smart enough who can predict VHF propagation. And Mel and I have taught people from time to time how to do that. And maybe we should go back and reteach, but there's ways you can calculate how many dB of gain you're going to get out of the antenna, how many watts of power you're transmitting, what's your feed line loss, how many miles of propagation is going to be, how many dB of loss. So if you know the altitude of your transmitting antenna, the power you're transmitting, you can make a rough approximation as to how many miles you're going to cover. And if it's only a trailer park you want to cover, the possibility exists that a pair of handy talkies with some kind of a controller between the two might, with a split-site repeater system, fulfill your requirement. Might. Now, Fred just signed in, but there's one person by head of Fred, and that's Howie. And then we're going to go to Howie first and then Fred in that order. Howie, I know you wanted to make a further comment. Go right ahead. K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, Dick, I want to make a couple of comments. First, I want to say, Mel, you're a man after my heart. I did the same exact thing when I was going to community college right out of high school. I had a TR-22, but I used a Navajo Pro 9 receiver, I have to say, and I had a bunch of relay. I had an old Western Electric 247B touchstone decoder. We used relay to do the logic, and we used, you know, UJTs to time us. God, brings back memory. But Dick, you don't want to go horizontal. You get much more separation with vertical separation if you have two antennas. But let me tell you something. You're better off using a single antenna. It's cheaper because you got to have duplicate feed lines. You can have duplicate antennas. You can get two GM300 commercial radios for about $100 a piece. And you can get very inexpensive, very inexpensive duplex, and you can, you know, tune it all up and get it working. If you got a group of guys, you get 8 or 9 guys together, each guy puts in $50 or $100, if you really cheapen it out, you can probably do it for $1,000. But Dick, when I was a kid and I had less than $300 in my pocket, I made the stuff that coaxial cable back then, and the same stuff. Wow, things have not changed. By the way, Dick, just to let you know, I'm on 10 meters. I'm using a P200. I'm coming into you guys from 10 meters, but best thing a guy can do is get a group of guys together and work on this project. But you got to get frequency coordinated. You got to go to the coordinating group. You got to decide you want to be on VHF or UHF. That's one of the things you have to decide on, what band you're going to do it on. It's probably easier to do it on UHF because you don't need as much separation and the cavities are smaller. So, but believe it or not, if you really scrap around, you can get some older equipment. If you want to, you can get a Micor Mobile. You can even do it cheap. You get a Micor Mobile for $30, $40 and, you know, rip it apart and set it up. Back to you, Dick. K2RAW, WD2HW.
Okay, good information. Boy, am I getting the impression we're kind of far and wide tonight. We're on two repeaters on Long Island, probably a repeater in the New England area. I need a repeater. Oh, boy. Fred? KC2OES, go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. I've been here before. My comment relates to two radios that are useful cross-band repeat capability. relatively inexpensive, even new. The model FT8800R is roughly $350, give or take. Crossband capability is a great radio for that purpose. It was pioneered from the FT8100R, which is an older model. Still capable of it, so for less than, as little as possibly $150, they could buy themselves a used 8100R and set up a small repeater in a small community, as you were talking about there. That was it. It's 2OEF.
Way to go, crossband.
Yeah, that's got a lot going for it. So I think you said that was a Fox Tango 88100R. Is that what you said, Chris? Go ahead.
FT8800R, there's a more expensive 4-band, but it's not necessary for that purpose. It's the 8900R, FT8900R. The older model is the FT8100R.
Oh, that last number, 8100R, 80100, run that by a little bit slower.
FT Foxtrot Tango dash 8100R is the older model. They could be bought for as little as $150. That was the first model that Yaesu experimented with in crossband repeat.
Good information. Thank you, Fred. Okay, Mel, why don't you go to one more mailbag, and then I'm going to have to leave you. K2KEY, H-U-R-I-W.
Something before you go on, please, is important.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
Those antennas on those radios, you've got to make sure you don't overheat them. One of these radios cannot do the duty cycle, so you have to run it lower power, and you definitely have to put heat sinks on it in advance. You've got to really cool the stuff down.
That makes a lot of sense. And a lot of these rigs, people put an auxiliary fan on them and get a lot more reliability. You got it, Mel. Wait for the beep.
Okay, I'll put this gentleman here, this retired gentleman that wants to put the repeater together. I'll put him in touch. I'll give him the information of who wound up with the repeater and all, and give him all the details of how to put this four-man repeater or basic together if he wants to do it. Very simple, very straightforward. All right, let's see. Here's the uncle, long-winded things and all. This gentleman asked here, I don't understand how a GPS system works. Can you give me more details? I think that's too much to get into. Let me see, I'm reading on. Okay, here's another question. Mel, yes, let's see. You once mentioned you converted a receiver from tube to solid state. Where did you get the plug-in to replace the tube? Well, I didn't use plug-in. That's the point. First of all, the receiver that I built was a solid state receiver, but I just rebuilt it. But I did make one other piece of equipment up that I did convert from tube to solid state, but I didn't use the plug-in. I wanted to get rid of the D-plus circuit and all, and the filament circuit, so I really made up my own individual solid-state replacement circuit individually. But the receiver you're talking about, that's that HRO 500 that I've discussed many a time on a TechNet. That was a solid-state receiver that I did enhance upon, really, because going through synthesized and filters and all that, basically that. As far as using these plug-in adapters, I don't know much about them. Are they still on the market? I don't know. These tube replacements, do you know anything about them, Dick Over?
No, I don't. But I know that people like N2EO and others who are quite enthusiastic about antique radios have a number of websites and vendors that you can go to that will either sell you the old tubes or tube replacement. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that the tube replacement solid state devices probably still exist. And they're not currently being manufactured, but I think there's a supply of them. So a person who really fell in love with a particular rig, my particular case, for instance, is the Drake R4C receiver. I'm guessing that was a 1980 or 1975 piece of hardware. But that radio has the most bulletproof receiver I have ever seen, and it's got a noise blanker in it that nobody has topped. I mean, that noise blanker, when I used it as a tunable IF on my 432 converter, and the Montauk Point radar was giving me a signal 120 decibels above my threshold, measured with a step attenuator right at the antenna. When the signal was that potent, and it was just wiping out the hold on band 10 times over, I could turn on that noise blanker, aim the high gain Yagi right at the Montauk Point radar, and a weak signal on 432 in the back lobes of the antenna over there in New Jersey would sound like he's in my backyard, and I would not hear any noise at all from the radar because of what that noise blanker can do. And the signal I'm listening to, the sideband signal from New Jersey, didn't have any noticeable distortion. That is a noise blanker. That is a bulletproof receiver. Now, if the day came that I'm on some band, whether it's a potent radar or some other kind of, let me drop, really intolerable noise, I'm going to take that Drake 4 R4C receiver off my shelf, put it back into service, but because it's got a whole bunch of tubes that are slowly getting gassy in there, I'm probably going to be the guy that's going to want to go out and buy solid-state equivalents for those tubes. I hope in those days they exist. So I'm pretty sure they do exist. I just don't know where to go for them. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, I will ask a question. Do you think it is worth just to take out a tube and put in a solid-state replacement? Because I wonder, is it an improvement over the tube other than getting rid of the filament? Because it's wired so that you're going to have to pick up the D-plus pin to, and then, of course, they most likely have built into that module some way of doing something with the D-plus to run this, the module most likely a much lower voltage and all. I would think that the way that I did it, one or two, I converted over BC221. I don't know if anybody out there is familiar with BC221. There's a frequency meter, and I liked it very much, but of course that was World War II, and was very heavy. I used it portable, and I had to use two B batteries on it, plus a B battery for the filament, and two 45-volt B batteries, and the A battery for the filament and all, and the batteries started to get potted to get those B batteries and things. I still want to use. In fact, I still have a little nice, great instrument. So instead of looking for these replacements, solid state, I actually took out the tubes and went circuit by circuit, and actually built modules, but solid state modules of my own that actually did fit into the sockets. They mounted into the oxygen sockets. But this way I came up and I was able to run it now off, I ran it off, I put some power supply, ran it off C battery. AC battery, Dick, over.
That's an approach. And you were smart enough not to modify the rig itself. Just by plugging things into the socket, you kept its vintage value. Particularly if it was a piece of Collins equipment. There are people who just love unmodified vintage pieces of Collins equipment with the original Collins label on it from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and they'll pay big money for it. So you didn't modify the rig itself, you just built these plug-in modules. And would I do it that way as opposed to buying the tube replacement? At my stage in life, I might just want to write a check and make the problem go away. And if they're available and not $1 zillion, I might buy the tube replacement. And as long as I'm convinced that the tubes that are replacing, that the solid-state equivalent replacements for those tubes had a similar third-order intercept point, a fancy way of saying the same amount of intermodulation distortion. And I think the answer was I'd get away with that because the rig did contain front-end tubes and IF tubes. but the super high performance noise blanker plug-in module, which is a large module by the way, did work with field effect transistors. So no substitution. The critical thing that I would be using the rig for already is solid state. My motivation for changing over from tubes to solid state is that anybody who's ever used those rigs discover that the tubes do go soft in time, and it seems like every 3 or 4 months you're replacing one of the tubes because it's got soft or stopped working or whatever. The tubes had nowhere near the reliability of properly designed solid-state equipment. So if I did resurrect that receiver, I would have a motivation to try to replace as many of the tubes as possible with a solid-state equivalent. That's probably the approach I would take. Back to you, Mel. H-U-R-I-W. This is the technical ed on Limehawk.
Good evening from N2EO.
There's the man. Rich, tell us, are there companies out there still supplying those solid-state equivalents for the tubes that go into a rig like a Collins or a Drake R4C? N2EO, H-U-R-I-W.
I don't know. I know there was a company making tubesters. You might check with Sherwood Engineering. They come up with a lot of mods on the Drake receivers. If anyone would have the replacements that they can ship, it would be Sherwood Engineering. But for many years I ran an R4B, and I ran the pants off. Tubes go off that quick. I mean, leaving it on day and night in those days, I would say I got 4 or 5 years out of a set of tubes. By the way, I guess you got my email on that Johnson Ranger 2 I just bought, and I just won 2 bids on eBay for a solid 7584 and a weight bottle, I don't know, like this, 37,000 serial number, round emblem, KWM2. Go ahead, Dick, and turn it over to Mel.
KWM.
Yeah, we did get those 2 pictures, Mel and I got the pictures that you mailed. And too bad that that Johnson Ranger, the front panel was so scratched up. Do you remember that one, Mel? That was a joke. K2KEY, you got it.
Hey, I'll let you go in a few minutes. It's getting near midnight anyhow, so we'll be closing down. Yeah, Rich, very good. As I mentioned to you, I have still have the Viking 2 and the NC303, and I did own the Ranger. I had one in pristine condition. I let somebody borrow it, but that was it. Big mistake. Anyhow, but what even though. What was going to answer a question? Oh, as far as tubes go, Dick, there's no problem getting them. This country company, Radio Days, I got their catalog here. Every tube that's in the Collins, that's in the Drake and all, they got those tubes still in the original boxes. They most likely bought up stock. The warehouses were full of them. They literally most likely got them for next to nothing. So if you want tubes, any of that, those radios, and as Rich says, they go and they go. I got still the original tubes in my Collins 8-4. Quite a number of them are still original, and it still works perfect. So it goes and it goes. You know, it's like that bunny, with the 9 line, what do they call that? The advertised the battery, the Duracell. They go and they go and they go. And that's the way it is with those receivers. If you need the tube stick, see, don't sweat it. You can get all you want. Just go to Radio Days. Go ahead.
Okay, that's good to know. Howie, you want to make a comment?
Dick, if you have a 1969 catalog of R.L. Drake, they had the actual schematic and part values for that.
Okay, I think you said they had the actual schematic and part value probably for the tube replacement. And I know that a number of people did take the Drake R4B and C receivers. I think I also had a Drake R4A or 2B. Had a pair of Drake receivers. Very good pieces of hardware in their day. And a number of my friends had gone over to the solid state equivalent. But if the tubes are reliable enough, the tubes did the job, maybe I'd stop worrying about it. Okay. Go to one more, Mel, and I'm going to have to leave you. K2KDY, K2RIW.
Okay, I think I'll let you let it go because we're 10 to midnight now anyhow, Dick, so no use getting involved with anything else that I said. I think we had enough for today. And it was great. Enjoyed the company, of course, at the ham fest. And sorry I had to leave so early, but my friend was not feeling well. He's got a blood pressure problem. Blood pressure went up quite a bit. He monitors all the time, and it's been a problem with him trying to get it under control. So I sort of waited with his eyes and everything was looking, you know, sort of glassy and everything. So I said, okay, come on, let's get you home. Anyhow, we'll pick it up next week. And anybody want to make any final comments? Richard, just curious, I don't know if you want to mention it or not, if you tell us what the final cost of this boat anchor station. I'm afraid of it. Maybe I should. Rich, would you like to tell us what the boat anchors are? Because Dick and I were hurt some prices today that were flabbergasted. We almost fell off our feet, to say the least. Go ahead, Rich.
WB2HWW, back, dead battery.
Okay. I will pick you up in a second, Howie. The price is severely appreciated. Like I sent you in an email that Viking Ranger 2 went for $1,300 because it was in pristine condition. One tiny scratch on the front, otherwise perfect. No rust on the chassis. All original tubes. I got it with the original Johnson box that came out of the original 8S on Fond du Lac Road in Wisconsin probably around 1962. The original manual and the original bag designed pin plug and fuses. I also got, I won a bid on 7584, serial number 2998, so it's right in the middle because I made 6,000 with a 3.1 and a 6K filter. That was like 8. And tonight I won a bid for 11 and change on a KWM2A. Late model, round emblem, with the extra crystal pack, is a VA model. And that is the round emblem from the 70s. Dad Mill?
That man's a collector. Wow. Okay, I'm going to leave you guys. What you guys have heard for the last 3 hours and 50 minutes was TechNet number 1176 of the series that began in September of 1982. Here we are 25 and a half years later, still doing it. Crazy people. You guys are at least mildly crazy too, because you could have been watching the Academy Awards. By now they're about to announce the best actress and the best actor, and you're listening about radio. Okay, we all set our priorities. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. I'll turn it over to Mel for any final comments. K2RIW and the TechNet. My mark, we're clear. I am.
This is for you. I just want to let you make note of this. R.L. Drake had a catalog in 1969. He actually showed the actual original schematic of that noise blanker.
That is one hell of a design. Over to you, Mel.
WBK, clear.
Thank you very much for being the MC and taking the load off me most of the time. And, Rich, very good. I had the Column 7584, which is dear to my heart. I use that receiver every night on 75 meters. It has moved off 75 now for quite a while. In fact, I don't move the old KWS-1 either off of 75. I don't like turning those switches and things too much anymore because of its age, you know, so it's hard to come by. And the rotary adductor and everything, gearing and all that stuff on the KWS-1 is starting to show its age. So my 75 meter station every night, KWS-1 and 75A4. Tell me, Rich, what did you pay for the 75A4? I'm very curious, over.
Okay, that was like 8 and change with shipping. It's coming from Alabama, and it is a, like I said, my understanding is that a 6,000 roughly, it's serial number 2,998. I got a pretty good deal because it came with a 3.1 and a 6K CAM filter. I'm going to use that with the Johnson Viking Ranger on 75 AM, and I've got a bid out now. I don't know if I'll get it on a 15R398, but you know there's a couple of days to go on that. But you know, I don't know if I'm going to keep or sell the Orion 2. I mean, the Orion 2 jet deck is probably one of the best of the modern radios, but you know, it's not like a college KWM2, and I got that round emblem coming in. It's KWM2A with pictures and sparkles. It was made, probably, I don't know if it says, I can't tell, it's a round emblem, I don't know if it says Collins or Collins Rockwell. You would know, it's a 37,000 plus serial number now.
Okay, to my knowledge, Rockwell, Collins Rockwell, did not make any M2s. I believe they only made the KWM 380 before they actually knocked off Collins as a name, you know, in that type of, well, they held it because of, you know, patent for a while, Rockwell. They sold this to some equipment under Collins' name, but nothing that our damages really were being, you know, concerned with. So I think that was still, most likely still made with at Collins in Iowa. A4, boy. I know we have talked about K60PZ's house today at the Ham Fest. He was telling me what the prices of that equipment have gone to. Some of it is astronomical, and especially things like the Collins KWS-1 transmitter. The KWM-2 was an excellent rig. It's not going to be compared, you know. We're comparing two different technologies from the M2, which was a great piece of equipment in the day, to comparing it to Pentax Orion. You know, heck of a lot of distance between the two pieces of equipment, Rich, over.
Oh, I don't know, I'm going to compare them to side by side. I may keep Pentax. I mean, I don't know, you know. I think, by the way, the repeater is going to shut off in a minute. I may join you tomorrow night. I was, when I sent you that email, I was sandbagging on 75 meters Friday.
Okay, be on 75 tomorrow night, 3.820, around 11:30. On, right, we have also a get-together like this. All right, yeah, the repeater's going to drop out. But what was I going to say? When you transmit with the Collins KWM-2, KWS-1, 32S-3, any of those rigs, all you get is compliments. Especially, they compliment me. Everybody gets on frequency and talks about that audio that comes out of that KWS-1. Of course, I did some tweaking of the audio. You know, I did. I had to modify a little bit here and there. But on the A4, especially the receiver, that is like it. When you listen to CW on that receiver, it's like listening to hi-fi CW. And I got three filters. I've got the CW filter, yeah. Side-band filter and the AM filter, my KAF 75A4. You may still find the other filter around somewhere. All right, with that, thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. And it's been a pleasure to also to meet many of you fellows out there at the AmFest tonight. Hopefully we can do this again in next week. 73 is all. Good night. Take care. This is K2KTY at the TechNet.